This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Word this week of three little piggies in American labs cloned and genetically engineered to produce omega-3 fatty acids. That is, pigs genetically engineered to become squealing little factories of heart-healthy pork, heart-healthy bacon. Omega-3 is the stuff that makes fish and walnuts so good for your heart. Some people don't like fish and walnuts, so is there any reason not to make the pigs make it? We've been eating genetically modified plant crops for years. Next comes the animal kingdom, and maybe that's great, but it has us wondering, is there a limit to what we can and should do to nature? Up next on Point, biologist E.O. Wilson and more, and a meditation on the pig. Joining me now from New York is Ivan Oransky. He's deputy editor of the New Scientist magazine. And with us first to explain what's up with the new cloned piggies. Ivan, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. It's actually the Scientist magazine.
Excuse me. Of course. I've got it right in front of me. The Scientist, yes. Ivan, what's up? Who's doing what here?
Well, a group of researchers have actually created piglets, that express, in other words, produce these omega-3 fatty acids, which are potentially beneficial to human health. No one's actually quite sure of that yet. I want to make that clear.
Mm-hmm.
And what they did was they actually cloned some what are called transgenic animals that include a gene. The gene's actually taken from a roundworm, believe it or not.
Okay.
And normally what happens when you and I eat something called omega-6 fatty acids, we can't convert them to these omega-3s, which are, again, the supposedly healthy ones, and pigs can't do that either. So what we need to do is either eat the omega-3s directly, which is what you were talking about in terms of walnuts and oily fish. Turns out some algae also produce them.
Mm-hmm.
Or you need to somehow get this enzyme, and that's not such an easy thing to do. So what they did was they took the gene for the enzyme from the roundworm, put it into some cells that were growing, some piglet cells, took the piglet cells, took a nucleus out of that cell, that's where all the DNA is, all the genome is,
right,
and put them into into an egg,
mm-hmm,
which hadn't been fertilized yet, and therefore created a clone. They took those clones, they became embryos, and inserted them into pigs, obviously into female,
mm-hmm,
pigs,
mm-hmm,
and created a number of pigs. Actually, only one of them ended up doing everything they wanted to do. In other words, was born, managed to survive, didn't have any significant health problems, and produced this omega-3 fatty acids.
Oh, I thought it was three. Somewhere I read 1,600 embryos, half dozen working pigs, quote unquote, and three that showed high levels of omega-3 production. But it's just one in the end out of 1,600 embryos.
What happened was, you're absolutely right about the numbers. So what happened was, again, and that sort of demonstrates how inefficient this process is right now. So three of the six pigs that were expressing the gene, that,
mm-hmm,
had the gene successfully, showed high levels of the omega-3 fatty acids. However, two of the transgenic pigs, and that's out of the six, not to get too complex here,
mm-hmm,
but out of the six were actually showing symptoms of heart failure. So they had to be euthanized.
Now, when you say these pigs, or this pig, out of all that expresses omega-3, expressing omega-3 means omega-3 will be in its body, including in its muscle, in the meat that humans might eat.
That's exactly right. And that is really the point of these experiments eventually in terms of the practical application. It's sort of neat science as well, and I don't want to sort of minimize that. I think even if these pigs never make it to market, as it were, the science behind this is actually quite interesting and kind of cool to talk about.
Very cool from a scientific point of view. They join the long list of animals, sheep, mice, rats, cows, goats, rabbits, a mule, horse, dog, that have been cloned. But when these scientists, and this was a group from the University of Missouri and Harvard Medical School, Pittsburgh Medical Center,
That's right. Actually, one of them, sorry to interrupt you, Tom, one of them is actually Tom Starzl, who, as you know, is one of the fathers of human transplantation.
Right. What are they aiming at here? Are they looking to put pork on the supermarket shelves that will make American hearts healthier?
Well, I think that obviously that's why there's interest in this. To be perfectly honest, though, this was in a journal called Nature Biotechnology, which is really scientists talking to one another about methods. And so this was sort of a neat method. They refined a method very well. We were able to do something fairly effectively, again, with a low efficiency rate, I should underscore.
Mm-hmm.
But so it's, you know, it's unclear to me what they actually, you know, hope to do eventually. And certainly scientists, as you know, are always cautious in their conclusions in the studies. So they don't come out and say, oh, we're going to put, you know, these piglets, we're going to put this pork on shelves right away. But clearly that's why they chose this gene to do.
And it's being received as, oh my gosh, here we go. We've had genetically modified corn and soybeans and all the rest, but now we're hitting creatures, the animal kingdom, and there's an awful lot that could be done here. And many are now saying, Ivan, will be done here.
Absolutely. Well, what's a little unclear is how healthy these pigs will actually be. So in other words, although on the face of it you would say, well, if omega-3s are good for you, and again, that's somewhat questionable, but if they're good for you, then what's going to happen to these pigs? So you might say, well, they'll be probably healthier than the average pig.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, there may be something kind of out of balance, if you will, for these pigs, which is why, and again, the scientists, when we covered this story, were very careful to say this, they really need to follow these pigs for a little while, for a long while, and see how healthy they are. The nice thing is that if they remain healthy, they won't have to go through this entire process again of cloning, because they now have animals that can reproduce normally that have this gene.
And they'll pass it on. Let me just ask you, Ivan, we've got to let you go, I know, but are you ready to chomp into a cloned pork tenderloin sandwich or not?
Well, luckily I can answer that question easily because I keep kosher, Tom.
not an issue for you, my friend, but a lot of people are going to be looking at the menu. Ivan Oransky at The Scientist magazine, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
I want to turn to Washington now and Michael Fernandez. He's executive director of the Pew Initiative on Food and Biotechnology. They've been looking a lot at these issues. Michael Fernandez, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
We're going to look at the science of this in some depth in the sort of big picture here. Biologist E.O. Wilson will join us in a moment, and we'll have a philosopher as well. But you're watching public attitudes, Michael, as we see headlines like this. I mean, even just today now, and this isn't something we're going to eat. Maybe in France, I don't know, but they've cloned a horse that's a particularly good at some rodeo trick. What do people think about not just plants, but animals now coming into the genetically engineered, potentially into the food chain?
Yeah, that's a very good question. We have done at the Pew Initiative on Food and Biotechnology a number of polls asking some of these questions. The first thing I would say is that most consumers at this point are still very much unaware of this technology and the fact that biotechnology products are in the food supply. So in the most recent poll we did in November of 2005, something on the order of 65% of the people responding said that they had heard not too much or nothing about genetically engineered animals, for example.
But when you're talking about plant crops, you've got huge amounts of it already in the food supply, and you're saying people don't even know that.
Exactly. Even if you ask just about genetically modified foods in general, something on the order of 60% of the people say that they have heard not too much or nothing.
And when it comes to animals, do people have a different attitude than, 80% of our soybean crop now is genetically modified? Do people think it's different if it's pigs or one day chickens or salmon, you name it?
Yeah, absolutely. People definitely respond differently when it comes to animals than they do to plants. Although people haven't heard as much, a majority of the people oppose research into transgenic or genetically modified animals. So 56% of the people that we polled said that they would oppose this idea.
They would oppose even the research, let alone eating it, just even doing research in transgenic animals after everything we've heard?
That's what we've heard in terms of our polling. When it comes to cloning, for example, that's another issue. Obviously, these animals, the pigs that you were talking about earlier, were genetically modified, but also through a cloning process.
Mm-hmm.
People have actually heard a little bit more about animal cloning, I think probably because of things like Dolly and just cloning in general.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Something about 66% of the people we polled said that they were uncomfortable with animal cloning when we sort of polled them on their comfort level.
Michael, how do you see the sort of big picture here of what's rolling forward? How are science and public attitudes, public insight lined up or misaligned at this point?
Well, I think that our results show that although consumers, when polled sort of a general question about, you know, about animals or cloning, for example, may respond negatively, there's a couple of things behind that. One is that most of the people don't have very strongly held opinions. So the vast majority of the people don't really feel very strongly one way or the other, and there's sort of a small percentage on either end that feel strongly in favor or strongly opposed.
Michael Fernandez, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We want to look at this from a biological angle, an evolutionary angle, a philosophical angle in this hour. Joining us right now from Lexington, Massachusetts, is E.O. Wilson, professor of biology emeritus at Harvard University, two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize, one of the world's most celebrated biologists. He's editor of the new edition From So Simple a Beginning, the four great books of Charles Darwin. He was author in 2002 of The Future of Life. It's a delight to have him. E.O. Wilson, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And with us from Philadelphia is Autumn Feaster. She's senior fellow at the Center for Bioethics and director of graduate studies in the Department of Medical Ethics at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. Autumn Feaster, thank you very much for being here.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
E.O. Wilson, you've written so much and so persuasively on this in The Future of Life. You write, the totality of life is a membrane of organisms wrapped around the world. The membrane is seamless. How do you hear this? Maybe it's nothing new to you, but take us into your view. When you hear about pigs being cloned and genetically engineered to bring us omega-3, does this sound like just exactly what humans should be doing, or does it sound like we're getting on a bridge too far? How do you look at it?
Well, I think that's still an ambiguous issue, and morally ambiguous in particular, which perhaps we can proceed to talk about with the help of Dr. Feaster. But I want to put the thing in perspective by saying that membrane that you just mentioned is being torn, ripped apart, plowed under, in a way that dwarfs into insignificance the genetic cloning or modification, gene substitution of a few domestic species.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to make any kind of judgment about what humanity is doing that really disturbs nature and constitutes a major moral question, I would think of it at much more important issues at two levels. One is the familiar destruction of the world's ecosystems,
mm-hmm.
and extinction, mass extinction of species. And the other is consideration of how we are treating these domestic animals that we have, the truly horrendous conditions under which they're raised.
You're talking about factory farming.
I realize these can be considered as auxiliary or at least put aside for the moment, but I just want to mention those things to put the whole issue in perspective.
No, it's well worth saying, and we spent all day yesterday talking about global warming, for example, what might be done to stop it. Yet there's a kind of, and that is becoming visceral and very evident in itself. We take your point that things are being torn up on a very large scale, but there's a kind of visceral questioning or apprehension when it comes to messing with animals and livestock that we're going to eat. Just at a biological level, Professor Wilson, do you see this as, is it safe? Is it all right to get in there with genetic engineering, fool around with pigs or beef or chickens or whatever eventually, throw it on the plate and chow down?
Well, we've been doing it for 10,000 years. You know, ever since the Neolithic Revolution, we've been steadily modifying the original species that we chose, about 20 species of plants primarily, and a dozen or so domesticated animals, and relentlessly changing them by artificial selection. There isn't much resemblance anymore between the wild fowl of the tropical Asian forest and, you know, its own life cycle and ways of life and anatomy on the one side, and the domesticated chickens on the other, or pigs and or pigeons or other domestic animals that have been the corn,
mm-hmm.
for example, have been drastically modified. Our forebears didn't have gene substitution to do it, but they did have mutations.
But you're talking
strains that they selected out, and the final effect was very similar.
But you're talking there about farming and animal husbandry and selection of traits over centuries. Here in an afternoon in the lab, we can clone a pig with entirely new features. Does it make any difference, the speed?
Well, the difference, of course, is in the rate at which this is happening, the extent of it around the world. Suddenly the genotypes have become very pliable material for molding in within weeks, as you indicate. So that's a very important consideration. Just how much are we going to change, and how many species is an issue to give thought to.
We'll look at that as well. Autumn Feaster, we're so glad to have you. You think a lot about the ethics involved here. So maybe we've been doing this for centuries one way or another, doing it in a new way now, but the intervention is more direct and certainly quicker and can seem very radical to turn pigs, for example, into a little omega-3 factories. Is it ethical?
Right. Well, I think the first thing to say about American biotechnology is it's a lot of the tail wagging the dog. Instead of having the public's needs or the public's interests driving the biotech agenda, we have scientists deciding what projects they want to pursue, and then they are turning back to the public and saying, will you accept this? Do you want to buy this? Or, in fact, you ought to buy this or approve of it.
Well, a lot of Americans have heart disease. It hardly seems like an irrelevant issue if you want to look at a widespread concern issue.
Well, I think that's false, actually. Mm. We certainly do have a serious problem, serious health problems in this country, chronic health problems that are caused by obesity and the types of foods that we eat. But we do not need a scientific solution to cure those problems. We are obese because we take in too many calories, and we eat unhealthy foods because of the foods we select, not because of the foods that are available to us. And as for omega-3, it isn't only naturally found in products that already exist, food products like walnuts and fish. There are also products on the market that contain supplements. For example, Smart Balance's peanut butter is omega-3 supplemented, fortified. So there's really no reason to take this dramatic step in altering the genome of an animal for this particular purpose. And by my perspective, this technology, as Dr. Wilson said, enables us to change animals with great speed, enables us to change the world at a rate and at a level we've never been capable of in the past. So now our position ought to be one of go very slowly, take ultra precautions. I think a default position of let's not do it unless we have compelling reasons, and instead we're in a position where we do anything and everything that interests scientists and any project they can get the funding for, and then we reflect on whether this is a product that we ought to or a research agenda that we ought to pursue. It's completely backwards.
Take us to the moral heart of it, though. We've been artificially selecting animals, livestock, as E.O. Wilson says, as long as humans have farmed and herded, as a moral issue. Is it different to clone and genetically engineer pigs? Is that different from fortifying peanut butter?
The answer, I think, is yes. But explaining why is very difficult, and philosophers and bioethicists are working very hard to articulate the widespread public view that it is different, that it crosses an important moral line, understanding that by one perspective, this can be seen as a continuum of manipulation of the natural world that has gone on through human time. But at this point, we can get into the very blueprints. And I think for the public, there is something morally distinct about being able to change an animal at the genetic level through genetic manipulation, as opposed to breeding or other types of processes that didn't enable us to get into the very DNA. For many people, the words they would use to describe this are hubristic or playing God or tampering at a level and at an extent that we've never been capable of doing it before. And that raises the moral significance or moral problem, a difficulty with this kind of research.
E.O. Wilson, how do you look across there? You've described people looking at this as Frankenfoods, Farmageddon, and yet, as you say, in slow motion compared to today, we have tinkered with the genetics of animals simply by selecting over a long time. Do you see a difference in kind here morally?
Well, yes, I think that Dr. Feaster makes a good point. If you take this case by case, particularly with reference to the diet of Americans and other well-fed people in the industrial countries, but let me broaden the perspective a little bit more, and that is point out that what else is accelerating around the world is the shortage of water, a shortage of arable land, the desperate need, particularly in the developing countries where 80% of the people of the world live and where virtually all the population growth occurs, for a higher productivity in crops, and particularly crops that can be grown locally, designed to some extent place for place, in order to produce a more balanced food supply and marketable products. And this, and furthermore, allow them to grow in areas that have gone into water shortage, which is expected to afflict 40% of the countries of the world within 20 years. We need crops, for example, that can be used in dry land farming, and we need perennials. And we need crops that can be grown in wasteland that is not now arable and saline environments and so on. So this is an area in which genetically modified organisms, especially crops and to some extent domestic animals as well, may have a strong moral argument behind it.
So you're saying genetic engineering may be the answer to a kind of human emergency?
Yes, absolutely. And there's an aspect to this. We are in an emergency. I mean, you just mentioned climate change. We've got to face that now as an ongoing problem. And it involves, for example, the drying out of much of Africa. It involves radical changes, latitudinal changes in crops that can or cannot be grown. So we have to face it now. But there's another aspect of it, referring back to nature. Nature is shrinking fast. The amount of land left for the rest of life, those tens of millions of species that co-evolved with us, that's disappearing. And it's disappearing in part through the developing countries because of inefficient agriculture and desperation of people and greed, corporate greed, of course, to acquire the last of the natural lands that can be converted to agriculture. And, so we need one of the best ways to protect the remnants of nature the rest of life is to do a better job with the land we've already plowed under.
But part of that, responding to the human emergency, may lie in genetic engineering. So, Autumn Feaster, you're the ethicist. For whatever, you know, for reasons that we're responsible for, maybe E.O. Wilson describes that Western civilization's Abrahamic view of the world, you know, may we take possession of this land that God has provided and let it drip milk and honey into our mouths forever. But now there's so many of us, we've got a human emergency. Where do animal rights stand once the emergency's there?
Right. I want to second everything that Dr. Wilson said. Genetic engineering has enormous potential to cure very serious problems that we are facing, many of which we created and some of which we've just encountered, like certain diseases. And we should, I believe, use genetic engineering, even of animal life, to cure those serious problems. But the second thing, the first thing that he said, which I want to emphasize, is that he talked about how reckless we've been, how destructive we've been. We also need to take that, we need to take great care as we select which projects of genetic engineering we pursue. From my perspective, to put omega-3 in American pork with a food supply that is safe and plentiful is a trivial use of a potential, enormously possibly helpful and productive technology. So again, we need to set the agenda based on human need. And then our default position of let's go cautiously, let's proceed slowly, can be overridden by very compelling moral reasons for us to pursue projects. So I agree. To help with famine relief, to increase water, biofarming is a new technology that might be able to produce drugs that we haven't been able to produce in other means. These are all great reasons to overcome our concerns and our nervousness with this technology. But our recklessness in creating bunnies that glow and special fish for the fish tank and enhanced meat in a country that has an abundance, an oversupply of food, and a problem of eating too much of it, that is trivial and frivolous in comparison when we think of the backdrop of the human need that exists, not in our country, but in all over the world.
The ethical issues go very quickly, very, very broad and wide here. I want to turn to our listeners. Marina's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Marina. You're on the air.
Hi. Actually, it's Nashville, New Hampshire.
Oh, excuse me. Good to have you.
All right. I'll make a couple of quick comments, and I'll take my response off the air because I'm in my car driving.
Yeah.
I think that this type of product would most likely give people false hope, because by focusing on the heart-healthy aspect of GE pork, we disregard the other rather harmful effects of pork or beef consumption at that, namely cancer, osteoporosis, kidney stones, and so on. And my second point was water supplies were mentioned as becoming scarce.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I wanted to point out that raising a pig requires a lot more water than raising plant foods, GE or not. So those are my two comments. No, not now. Thank you for taking my call.
There's the vegetarian on the road. E.O. Wilson, in terms of the relative allotment of resources, you've got a lot of scientists who worked on this pig project. Are you saying it's just the wrong thing to be doing?
Well, I think, yes, Dr. Feaster makes a very good point when she says that in terms of possible applications to human needs, the pork inoculation is tends to be frivolous, and as far as eating habits, I'm in the and the collateral risk of pork. I'm personally trying to become a vegetarian. I don't think I'm going to succeed, but at least I'll go partway there.
Yeah, getting a start on it. Lee is calling from Arlington, Virginia. Hi, Lee. You're on the air.
Can you hear me?
Loud and clear. What do you know, Lee?
Let's see. Hold on. How's this?
Much better, thank you.
Okay, I had a headset on. I was calling to say that I agreed very much with the woman who was speaking that it is the human hubris to mess with a pig's genome to suit our own nutritional or dietary needs. It's totally humans not taking responsibility for their own diet. To go and do something like that to a pig to serve us.
But farmers have effectively done it for centuries and more, Lee, with choosing the animals that they wanted to breed and have reproduced, selecting traits.
That's breeding. Mm-hmm. That's breeding. This is genetic, changing the genetic makeup of a pig by scientifically, Sorry,
we're getting right in there, and we feel the distinction you're drawing. But let me ask you, Wilson, is there really a difference, Dr. Wilson?
In one sense, yes. Actually, what's happened in the artificial breeding programs of the last 10 millennia or so has been that farmers, animal breeders, waited for mutations to occur.
Mm-hmm.
And these mutations then were bred into the population of cultivated animals or plants by artificial selection. And the result then was a modified form with new genes or gene ensembles that could not survive in nature. They really were a departure from the original. So in that sense, what's being done now is a continuation of the old. What's new is the source of the genetic change and the rapidity with which the technology can be applied.
You write about the sturdiness of nature, of human nature, and nature generally. But when we do this at high speed, I mean, those farmers, over those millennia, there was a kind of evolutionary element here. The mutations that didn't work out melted away over a long time. They didn't spread quickly. They certainly weren't on supermarket shelves all over the planet right away. Do we make our biosystem even more fragile with these high-tech engineering interventions, in your view, or are they so marginal that it doesn't really matter?
Well, that's been a very principal concern on the part of the environmentalists, whose voice has not been much heard in this argument,
mm-hmm.
The genes from the genetically modified organisms could spread out by hybridization into natural populations, and that we might even produce something like super weeds, you know, or
mm-hmm.
super bugs that could penetrate into the remaining natural environments. And I've looked through a lot of those cases, as have other ecologists, biologists, they do occur, but they're still quite rare compared to the amount of potential that we had before
mm-hmm.
and then during genetic modification. Right now, that does not, and there may be others who will quickly disagree with me,
mm-hmm.
it does not appear to be an imminent danger of harming natural ecosystems this way. The important thing that can happen, or the deadly thing that can happen, is that we continue to disturb and modify the natural ecosystems, and then they become more vulnerable to genetic modifications and invasions of this sort.
What about secondary effects of these altered creatures, now animals? I mean, do we really know, when we have pork suddenly producing omega-3, that sounds good from one perspective, but do we really know what all the impacts of that are? Or might we find out, you know, in a couple of generations that it had some, that this particular kind of omega-3 was bad for humans?
Yeah. Well, for the pig and for people, that's
yeah.
why we have an FDA, and why we have public health experts, and why we have nutritionists and biochemists and others. I think that Dr. Baranski pointed out
mm-hmm.
that we have to wait for a number of generations to see the secondary effects on the pigs themselves of making this substitution, because almost no genes, whatever their origin, have a single effect. They have collateral effects almost always, and those are what you have to watch for. Ill effects come evident only after a few generations.
Are you confident that the FDA and our regulatory bodies will have a true bead on that before this genetically engineered pork is in the supermarket?
Am I confident?
Mm-hmm.
Not entirely.
Heather's calling from Boston. Hi, Heather. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Well, what do you think, Heather?
Well, I was thinking, it seems that genetically modifying a pig, for example, in this case,
mm-hmm.
To produce omega-3, let's say it doesn't affect the quality of life of the pig.
In fact, some are saying it may even help the pig's heart health.
Right, okay. But mm-hmm. every day people eat eggs from chickens that are stacked 100 high that excrete on each other,
right.
you know, and beef that's raised in appalling conditions. What about the morality of the everyday food that we eat anyway?
Well, let's turn to Autumn Feaster. Autumn, do you see a difference in the moral issues between, let's say, factory farming? Heather and others clearly don't like the way that works, and opening up the test tube and beginning to clone.
Right, and this was something that Dr. Wilson actually mentioned earlier in the program as well. I don't think that the issues are different or more severe. There's just more of them when you have genetically modified pigs. So I agree. We take a baseline of appalling conditions in factory farming for many species of animals, but pigs and chickens, you've named the two that probably receive the worst possible treatment. And we are not doing enough to cure those ills, and it is inhumane, and it's astounding that we've let this go on so long. But then on top of that, ironically, we start then modifying so the pig, who is already in agriculture treated abysmally, and now we start to research on the pig and modify the pig. So we add all of that suffering that goes on in the given that the inefficiencies, given we're not sure what the health status will be of these animals. It's well known that neonates, cloned neonates, have problems at least a certain percentage, and that changes by species. But we add another layer on top of the suffering that's already going on in factory farming when we then start to have modified animals of the species that are already being badly treated. Absolutely.
Let me ask you about that. E.O. Wilson points out that the FDA and other regulatory agencies are there to look at the health safety issues. But as we charge into this era of cloning and genetic engineering, is there an ethical counterpart to that? Is anybody kind of tracking the ethics of what's going on?
This is an excellent point. And in fact, the Pew Initiative has wonderful data to show that the American public really wants to have a regulatory body that will think about the social, economic, and ethical issues of these products that are going to come to market beyond the health and safety. And at this point, the FDA sees as its mandate only the judgment about health and safety. But Americans want to have a regulatory body that will judge individual projects in biotechnology and assess them on their ethical or social merits. We absolutely need such a regulatory body, and if the FDA cannot expand its mandate to increase the group of people who would assess this, because of course they're not qualified at this point, then it has to go beyond the FDA, and we have to have a regulatory body. It is time now for us to judge individual technology cases on their merits, their pros and cons, their cost to the environment, and other resources. Absolutely, we must do this, and we do not have that ability right now in this country.
Now that would make for some amazing hearings and conversations, but conversations we need.
Other countries have done it. Mm-hmm. Other countries have done it. For example, England has done it on embryo use. So there is a model. Canada looks like it's moving towards this. So we could do it. Mm.
Will's calling from Lunenburg, Massachusetts. Hi, Will. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say something about the – I'm a little dubious about the how much will actually happen in this country because of the huge – monetary advantage that companies have over this. They're doing this not because they just can to experiment, but there's a potential billion-dollar market for selling people more pork, you know, bacon that they already want another excuse to eat. So what, I guess the question of the panel is, you know, what can we do as citizens to get the FDA to be sort of provide a counterbalance to that huge marketing pressure to be able to do this to provide essentially just more product.
Will, let me ask you first, do you think this will sell? Do you think that genetically engineered pork, if it's packaged right, will fly off the shelves, so to speak?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, people already want it, you know, they love bacon. So now to be able to have another excuse to eat heart-healthy bacon, you know, they'll, you know, since they're going to buy bacon anyway, now this, you know, provides, you know, that much more market share for whoever can do this.
We can see the packaging already. Will, thanks for your call. E.O. Wilson, I'm looking here at Dr. Alexander Leaf, Professor Emeritus of Clinical Medicine at Harvard, quoted in the Times saying, you know, this is exciting and it will leave American consumers better off. People can continue to eat their junk food, he's quoted as saying. You won't have to change your diet, but you will be getting what you need. You can hear the beginnings of the marketing thinking, even though he comes at it from a scientific view right there. So is it inevitable, and is intervention required, or will the market just take it away?
Well, you know, that's a, how shall we say it? That's a rather focused point of view, isn't it? I think that the real problem here is that our moral reasoning and our regulatory policy and the philosophy behind them in this country are schizophrenic. That is to say, Americans tend to live from moment to moment and problem to problem. And what we really need is a locking together in scholarship and public perception and public discussion of all of the issues that impinge upon and are affected by episodes like like the safe bacon, because you really can't make a judgment about individual changes and challenges of this kind in a market-driven
society without having some conception from the top down of what the consequences are in the individual person's body, in the economy, in the effect on the rest of the world, on the environment. It's not impossible to do this. This is what we should be doing in terms of scholarship and public education, trying to put these things together and help people to think about them.
We're trying to knit together some of that conversation right here. Let me ask you, E.O. Wilson, you write in your book, The Future of Life, you say the race is now on between the techno-scientific forces that are destroying the living environment and those that can be harnessed to save it. Where do you put the genetic engineering of animals in that race?
Well, for animals, not a very important role, but for plants, for crops, vegetable crops, I put give it a very high rating if well managed for its beneficial effect.
Andrew's calling from Marblehead, Massachusetts. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
I was wondering about whether or not the panelists know if the award-winning Amartya Sen has endorsed genetically engineered foods as a way to fight hunger. I'd be sort of surprised to find out that he had, because I don't really think that a lack of food is the reason why so many people go hungry every year. And I really tend to doubt that.
A lack of food is not why they go hungry?
I think it's the distribution of food that is the bigger problem, possibly the waste and the allocation of resources and aid. And I don't really think that the pharmaceutical industry needs genetic engineering in order to develop drugs, but they might need better ways of getting those drugs to poor people everywhere.
Yep. Andrew, thanks for your call. Autumn Feaster, we just got a couple of minutes left here. Take us home. How do you suggest, people who don't sit on an FDA panel or a high ethical panel of any sort, but are making their own decisions and thinking about this in their own way, how do you suggest they begin to balance out the science is charging ahead and their view of it?
I think one thing to say is, this is response to the second to the last caller, it is not the case that it's just biotechnology industry that is driving this research. Many, many dollars are coming from NIH, and that's taxpayer money. Mm-hmm. And if taxpayers didn't want to fund that kind of research, they could start to have some protest and some opposition to it. So the first thing to know is a lot of this research is funded by NIH, and we pay for that. The second thing to say is I don't believe that the market forces are actually going to turn a profit for this kind of product. I don't think that Americans want milk from cloned animals, and I don't think they're going to want to eat bacon from genetically modified pigs. I think that that's a miscalculation on the industry's part, and so far we don't actually have a lot of these new industries making any profit at all. So I think that by our purchases we can take a stand on what products we want to promote. And I think one last thing, which is to the last caller who said we don't need pharmaceutical companies to produce new drugs. I think that's false. There are many diseases that the pharmaceutical industry has not been able to create therapies for. Biofarming, which is the insertion of a genetic material into, let's say, a goat or a sheep and then getting the milk and refining it, that might actually be one of the answers. We need to think long and hard about that.
Well, I'm grateful to both of you for helping us open up the issue today and really look a lot broader. Autumn Feaster at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine, Center for Bioethics there. Thank you very much for joining us in this hour.
Thank you.
D.O. Wilson, it's always wonderful to speak with you. Thanks a lot for sharing your thoughts.
Thanks, as always.
Professor of Biology, Emeritus at Harvard University, E.O. Wilson, author of The Future of Life. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.